Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most people fear Big Brother, the idea that government or corporations can spy on our daily activity. Now that smartphones have location sharing options, the tools actually exist to achieve a Big Brother sort of society. Family and friends use the tool to check in on one another, and it has advantages. But the lines between caring, overbearing, and spying are tricky. New York Times reporter Nick Wingfield wrote about the phenomena recently. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nick, how does the technology work?
The way it works is, standard cell phones today, there are all sorts of tracking technologies, wireless tracking technologies, that can geolocate you, to tell with a pretty high degree of accuracy where you are on a map. What's happened is that companies like Apple in the iPhone have made these tools a lot easier to use so that you can now essentially add friends or family members to a list of contacts that you can track pretty much all the time if they offer their consent to be tracked all the time. And so you can just see, your kids, your spouses, whoever, on a map as they move about, your neighborhood or the city.
How does that consent, how is that established?
Well, they have to essentially confirm that through their phones that you are allowed to track them. It gets a little dicier when you're talking about parents and kids because, many parents will establish sort of ground rules for giving kids phones. And so has a teenager really offered consent when a parent has said, you can have this phone as long as you consent to be tracked? But that's kind of how most families work it out. Essentially, you have to confirm that you're willing to be tracked.
You use tracking apps. Tell us what you like about them and why they're helpful.
Yeah, this for me started with really kind of a way to reduce a lot of the communications that goes on with my wife. We track each other through our phones, and the reason that we do it is for those situations where she might be leaving work, and rather than send me a text message telling me that she's on her way home so that I know how to, time dinner, I can just see where she is. I can see she's a half mile away. And then put the pasta in the water. Now, for my daughter, it's a little bit different. She has a cell phone, and she has a certain amount of freedom to kind of do her own thing. But it's helpful to know when she goes for a run. That she's still that I can see that she's still moving and she's coming home, and she doesn't have to be hassled with text messages from me. So it seems to work out pretty well, but. These technologies can easily be abused.
What are some of the danger signs for when these tools are being abused in a relationship?
Well, the really extreme cases, which can't be discounted, are when people start stalking, boyfriends or girlfriends or their children, or overbearing parents are becoming too intrusive in their kids' online habits. And that kind of behavior is actually fairly common. What I talk to researchers about who study sort of digital privacy and teenagers in particular is that, these technologies tend to amplify, if they're toxic relationships, they tend to amplify these toxic relationships and can easily become abusive. But in families where there's kind of open lines of communications, then, they can be used responsibly. And in fact, a lot of parents or, significant minority of parents are using some of these tracking technologies to keep track of their kids.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with New York Times reporter Nick Wingfield about tracking technology on smartphones and how it can be used and abused. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out your Facebook page and post it there. Mary Madden of Data and Society, a nonprofit research organization, said that we're moving closer to a world in which parental surveillance becomes opt out instead of opt in. What did she mean by that?
I think what she means is that, you know, it's just become commonplace now for parents to kind of introduce cell phones into their, you know, to give them to their kids at a certain age. And more often than not now, that those mobile devices, and also to some extent just normal use of computers, is coming with strings attached to it in terms of tracking. Some parents look at the websites that their kids visit. They may have software through their router at home that allows them to see what websites their kids are visiting. There are a variety of ways to do this. And in some cases, it's tracking. I mean, the Pew Research has done a survey that shows that 16% of American parents are keeping track of their kids through location tracking software. So, and it's growing. So, really, if you're going to opt out of it, if that's even possible, you know, you're going to have a frank conversation as a kid with your parents about how, you know, their kind of digital snooping is becoming a problem for you. But more often than not, parents like mandate it as sort of the ground rules for using digital devices for their kids.
Can you describe to me a scenario that that expresses what you're talking about, where it's a step too far?
Well, I mean, it depends. There are the extreme examples of people who become, you know, jealous of their spouses and are constantly trying to figure out if they're communicating with, you know, with other people, if they're being cheated on. I actually think the more common scenario is parents who just can't learn to give their kids the kind of independence that they need to become full-fledged adults. You know, it's one thing to keep track of your 13-year-old's whereabouts when they're going out for a run. It's another thing to, you know, really keep track of your 17 or 18-year-old's whereabouts and constantly badgering them with questions about what they're up to. I think that really, you know, according to psychologists and people who are sort of familiar with the development of kids, this can become an issue quickly if you're not willing to kind of give them the space to, you know, develop into more, you know, mature adults.
And the Dana, I think it's pronounced Dana Boyd, the founder of Data and Society, said that in your article that privacy standards that we have with our children establish the standards that they share with their peers. And how so? What does she mean by that? Or he,
This is one of the things that was really shocking to me. Dana Boyd has done a lot of field research with teenagers and how they use social media. And one thing that she found was fairly common is that teenagers will often give passwords to their social media accounts or, you know, other services to their friends as a sign of trust. In other words, a boy might ask a girl for a password to a Instagram or a Snapchat account in order to, I don't know, verify who they're communicating with, and that this is given as a sign of trust. And she theorizes that one of the reasons that kids find this acceptable is that parents have said to their kids, "You will give me your password to your social media account or your email account or something like that." And therefore, if parents are doing it, you know, it must be okay for teenagers to give them to their friends.
You know, I don't get that. I mean, why is there that transference in that way? Is it has something to do with technology versus, hey, my mom grounded me last week, and because I did something wrong, you just ticked me off. I'm grounding you. I don't get the parallel there.
There are a lot of things that I don't understand about how teenagers use technology either, but I was pretty surprised when I talked to my own daughter. I don't think she's shared her password with other people, but she said it's fairly common for people she knows to do it. And you know, she thinks more often than not it ends up in just sort of boring scenarios where, you know, people are checking in on text messages and that don't really actually reveal all that much. But I can see how it would easily be, could turn into a bad situation.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think that people forget that Apple or Google or whatever tracking application you're using is also collecting your location information? Is this something that's just becoming so omnipresent that we forget about it?
I think that people have become concerned about it to the extent that they're aware of it. I mean, you know, we all have these sort of familiar experiences of searching for something on Google, and then going to Amazon and then seeing an ad for a pair of sneakers track us around the internet. I think that people are becoming they are concerned about commercial tracking, but as long as they feel like their trust is not being abused, they seem to be okay with it. Now this whole sort of phenomenon of family tracking, I think, is going to introduce new challenges into families as these tools become more sophisticated. I mean, I think in some ways, we're going to have to develop a whole new set of education for families to kind of sort of figure out like how, what the rules of the road are for, for responsibly using these tracking technologies. People are sort of making it up as they go along right now.
Right. So there's not a guidebook out there yet.
I don't think so, no. And I mean, what happens is very often technology companies introduce new tools and, people just run with them and use them without, sort of figuring out all the implications ahead of time. There are some tracking technologies that will allow you to consent to have your location tracked for a limited period of time. There are apps that will let you do this. So for a half hour, 45 minutes, that may be one approach to doing it, and perhaps Apple will introduce, more fine-grained tracking technologies in its smartphones in the future.
So what are you planning on with your daughter, for example, when you start to stop tracking her?
Well, I mean, in some ways, we have already started moving in that direction. One of my philosophies is not to be obnoxious about this. She is aware that I can track. She can also track me if she wants to. I doubt she's ever done it. But I don't try to... I don't constantly remind her that I can do this. And she's proven incredibly trustworthy and responsible about it. But I can see, at some point when she has more freedom as a 17 or an 18-year-old, stopping this, not doing it anymore, provided that she stays in touch with me, in other ways. Mm-hmm. So I think, we'll test the waters as she gets older.
All right. Well, Nick Wingfield, thank you for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Nick Wingfield. He's a New York Times reporter, and we'll have a link to his article in the New York Times about families and tracking tools on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Fake news went viral on social media in 2016. Some claim that fake news contributed to Donald Trump's presidential victory and blame Facebook for allowing the proliferation of false stories. At first, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg dismissed the claims, but he said that now he is taking the problem seriously. The director of International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies in Florida, Alexios Mantzarlis, has written about the phenomena of fake news. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What constitutes fake news?
Well, that's a part of the problem we have in the current conversation. I'm concerned that there's been a conflation of fake news and misleading information or hyperpartisan information. Fake news should be just news that is entirely made up or whose facts are entirely inaccurate.
And where it's entirely apparent, say, like satire or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, satire is perhaps even an additional type of fake news. And on this, I would recommend a piece written by Claire Wardle on the Columbia Journalism Review. And she spots six different types of misinformation. I think fake news is something we can attack, but we need to circumscribe the phenomenon and make sure we don't conflate it with others.
Do the majority of fake news reports come from the same sources? Are there certain Facebook pages that are commonly introducing untrue content that becomes popular?
I mean, for sure. There was analysis by Craig Silverman at BuzzFeed News. One page in particular, Ending the Fed, scored a few fake news hits. I can't remember another name. I think it's called 70 Page Something, which made up that the popular vote went for Trump and was even able to fool Google, not only Facebook. So there are a few of these pages that are very, very successful.
Is our fake news procurers or people who produce fake news, are they doing it to influence people, or are they doing it for money, or what are they doing it for fun? What's the deal?
I mean, everything we've seen up to now seemed to indicate that the number one incentive for these fake news writers is financial. They can, if they have a great Facebook reach, they can bring more people on the site. Their ads pay more. And since this news is entirely made up, it doesn't cost very much to write. And so if you're bringing in $20,000 or $30,000 a month from ads, that's great because you don't really have that many costs, do you?
Does Facebook have something to gain from allowing fake news stories to go viral on its site?
I mean, what goes viral is engaging, and so to the let me take a step back. Things go viral because a lot of people comment, like, and share a specific item. And so the more people interact with content on Facebook, the better it is for Facebook, because it means that it has a more captive audience. Now, I wouldn't go as so far as to say that they are happy with the fake news phenomenon. They were slow to react to it. Painfully slow, but I feel that they finally realized that it is a problem for the reputation of the site.
You know, you make the point that nobody really knows how big of a deal this is because Facebook doesn't reveal the data.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of people who are smarter than me could look at this data and try to figure out whether there are ways to intervene on the spreading of rumors that goes beyond the mere flagging of fakes and the reducing the reach of these fake news pages. For my part, I think that could be already a good start.
So what is Facebook doing?
It's, you know, the all we know right now is what Zuckerberg posted on Friday night. They are looking at ways to introduce third-party fact-checking. They are looking at ways to enhance the reporting process so that users can more easily flag fake news. It's hard to tell where exactly this will lead them. I believe they do have they can very much tackle the more viral fake news. Whether they can eliminate fakery from Facebook altogether is another question, of course.
So they introduced the ability for users to flag content as fake in early 2015. Do we know how many items have been flagged since then?
No, and that's part of the same problem with transparency we were mentioning earlier. Not only do we not know how many people need to flag something in order for it to be annotated as fake to other users, what other factors go into deciding, and also the process. I was talking to a designer. The process of reporting the fake seems to dissuade people, right? Seems not to be designed in quite the same captivating way that all the other interactions that you can have on Facebook are designed. So it wasn't really thought of as something, it didn't seem at least, like something that they really wanted to incentivize that much.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Alexio Manzarlis. He is director, editor of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies in Florida. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about fake news on social media. Facebook is trying to address it. Critics aren't necessarily satisfied with your efforts so far. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook CEO, has said that of all the content on Facebook, more than 99% of what people see is authentic. How do you – do you think he knows that, or that it's just sort of that, you know – just a turn of a phrase there.
Yeah, I mean, I think if he believes that to be true, it's extremely disingenuous. I think because it was written in a post rather than an off-the-cuff remark, I am afraid that he does believe it a little bit, at least. And so there must be some kind of internal research.
Or that he wants us to believe it.
Oh, well, that for sure. That for sure. But even presume that even that is true. 99% of all content on Facebook isn't what 99% of people see, right? The status that you and I can write about how great our Sunday lunch was is not going to reach the audience that a viral fake about the election does. And we saw, again, to mention Craig Silverman's great work, that in the final months of the election, the top posts by fake news pages were outperforming the top posts by legitimate news sources. And so the question isn't 99% of the total content. The question is, what percentage of the most shared, liked, and engaged with content is fake? And I suspect that it's a higher percentage than 1%.
Carolyn in Pickaway County, you're on the air. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Ann. I wanted to call in and just share an observation that we have actually, for decades, been exposed to false news in the grocery store aisles. As we're checking out, the National Enquirer is there with the fake headlines and the false stories. And people either chose to buy it and be sucked in by those fake stories, or they didn't. But it was, as we're saying, it was a very small percentage of the population. But now it's as though everybody has become gullible. They're grasping at these fake stories. And I don't understand what has happened to our society that we are so gullible and so easily led by the nose.
Yeah, well, you know, Alexios, what is it about, you know, Facebook users, social media users, that's different than, you know, standing in line at the grocery store?
Yeah, I think Carolyn makes a great point in putting things into context, right? Hoaxes are not new on Facebook, nor new to the internet. The problem with Facebook is that the way its newsfeed is constructed, if I am, for example, a National Enquirer consumer, a reader of fake news, and I click and comment and share this stuff, I'm going to get more and more of it. So to stretch the analogy a little bit, instead of, you know, just it being one of the various titles you see on the grocery aisle, like if you read enough of it by, you know, 6 months or 1 year in, like your entire aisle is covered in National Enquirers and, you know, you're flooded with clippings of the articles that you've been reading most. So the problem isn't just that it provides a big audience to hoaxes. It is also that it sort of hones in this content onto people who are already reading more of it.
Carolyn, thanks for that call. Michelle in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. Good morning. I'm really interested in this topic. I have folks in my family who are notorious for spreading this viral incorrect news. And I'm wondering if you guys can expand on the fact that even though I would say go to Snopes, those folks in my families would refute that as being biased. And even if you had the social media check from Mark Zuckerberg that said this is a questionable news source with confirmation bias, with other issues that people don't want to believe it. So So how much do you think that the audience that is making this go viral would actually respond to a fake news flag?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, Michelle. I think there are, as you mentioned, hardwired elements of the human psyche, the confirmation bias and motivated reasoning that makes us prefer things that we are more attuned to and explain away things that are not. I'd say two things to this. One is that a recent study by Porter and Wood, two researchers from George Washington University and Ohio State, found that systemically, if you fact check people, overall they do move towards the more accurate understanding of the facts. So I would venture that, you know, if anecdotally we know of family members or friends who are resistant to correction, that is not necessarily an across-the-board phenomenon. The other thing I'd say is that there are ways and ways to correct. Correcting someone harshly by saying, don't be ridiculous, that's a fake news story, doesn't allow someone a way out if they were, so to speak, if they had good motives to believe it. If there is a way to explain why they were fooled to believing that there was maybe something in their personal experience that led them to believe that, but that fake news is still not generalizable, that is a better way to explain, to correct someone and to get them out of the misinformation.
Thank you, Michelle, for that. Charles in Mount Vernon, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Hey, not too bad. I just wanted to say that we shouldn't be trying to restrict people's right of freedom of speech, and this is a very dangerous slope we're on, and it could lead to a lot more things, especially with China saying for us to do this, and they're communists. And that's it. I just wanted to put my statement in.
Well, what I mean, you're saying that to flag things as fake, it hampers free speech?
Well, yeah, because I could get on there and post anything I want. Mm-hmm. And then that's just like somebody coming and telling me, oh, you can't say that.
But what if it's actually factually incorrect, like the earth is a sphere and you say the earth is flat?
Well, what I'm saying is, like, the lady that called in just a minute ago was talking about the inquirers.
Yeah.
They're not after them.
Right. Okay.
You know, so they can't do it for one if they're not doing it for all.
All right. Okay, Charles. Well, thanks a lot. I understand what you're saying. Alexios, you did describe a little earlier that there's more concern about this because the very nature of social media and how it's used and how it, the revenue, the business model for it works, is it multiplies.
Yeah, I mean, and I am partial to the concern that Charles flags, even though I'm not certain what he means by bringing up China. I do think that Facebook is on a tightrope, tightening too much, too big of a clampdown on news that is considered to be fake could be an equally unwelcome next step here. But there are, you know, there is a big universe of news sites that are populated exclusively by information that is made up, and that, you know, that we've had interviews with the people behind these sites, great interviews on the Washington Post, for example, and they do not hide that this information is false. Or kids in Eastern Europe who are post, you know, ripping up stuff and jumbling it together and posting it online purely out of a concern of making money out of the ads. So I understand where the concerns about free speech are. I don't think that a proper understanding of where some of these fake news sites are coming from actually warrants that concern.
I've been having conversations with people lately who want to check out of Facebook.
Yeah, I mean,
they want to close their site. They want to close it all down, and they have thousands of followers.
That's why, I hate to be cynical here, but that's why Zuckerberg is now acting, right? This is a PR nightmare for the company. And the moment in which this becomes something that users decide is a problem is when Facebook will become 100% serious about addressing the problem.
You know, Alexios, I've been in journalism for more than 30 years, and mostly in newspapers. And And I've been to Poynter many times, and I don't remember there being an international fact-checking network. When did this become a thing?
Yeah, we're new. Okay. So we launched the network last year. I was tapped to be the first director. Uh-huh. And it sort of reflects a growing thirst for this form of journalism around the world. Interestingly, outside of the United States, it is actually mostly nonprofits and civil society that are setting up fact-checking organizations outside of the newsroom because of the very same tools that the purveyors of fake news are using, right? The internet is giveth and it taketh away. And so it has become also a lot easier for fact-checking for individuals and organizations to start fact-checking.
And in other countries, in Europe in particular, they're a lot stricter about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there has been regulation, and of course, I only read it quickly so listeners can fact-check me, but I believe that the German government has been monitoring the extent to which fake news have been spreading and considering action, which is something that here wouldn't be imaginable.
Yeah, right. Exactly. There'd be fears of censorship.
Yeah, and I'd mention one thing. I get trolled regularly by especially one user who keeps saying that any kind of action by Facebook would be a violation of the First Amendment. But I've spoken to lawyers who specialize in the First Amendment, and they note that, you know, the First Amendment covers encroachment by the government, and that if Facebook starts to decide to change its policies, that's not a problem because you can just shut down your Facebook account and move somewhere else. So it isn't a First Amendment issue that some people get huffy and puffy about.
Well, and also, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, libel, slander, that kind of thing. It's not libel or slander if it's true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You mean about fact-checking, right?
Like right.
Correcting someone for saying something true that right. isn't accurate. Of course, absolutely. I come from Italy, and when we set up our fact-checking organization, we were extremely concerned that our suit-happy politicians would sue the hell out of us after our fact-checks. And, you know, knocking on wood, years in, the organization has yet to be sued.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Alexio Matzarlis is the director editor, the first director editor of the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies in Florida. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The day after Thanksgiving is the traditional kickoff to the holiday shopping season. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are famous for promises of great deals. That is, if you want to stand in line or stay glued to your computer screen. Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, is here to help. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So before we look at specific gadget deals in general, do you think Black Friday and Cyber Monday are worth the hype when it comes to technology?
I think it really depends on what kind of consumer you are. I think if you are the kind of person who enjoys getting, you know, kind of the latest technology the day that it's out, if you stand in line for an iPhone or you're there the day that an Xbox is released, then Black Friday is probably not something you're interested in because you already have that stuff probably. Or you're looking to get it as a gift for someone. On the other hand, if you use this as an opportunity to kind of upgrade what you already have, or if you're looking for gifts for other people, and you're willing to kind of wait in line or you know, sit in front of your computer screen and refresh endlessly, then it can be worth it.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about deals on, you know, Black Friday and Cyber Monday coming up. My guest is Russell Holly. He is the contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com. If you have a question or comment about deals coming up this season, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to call Russell back real quick and fix that connection. We're talking about a couple different things, Huawei Honor and Honor 8 smartphone. We talked about it before. We're going to talk about that some more. Also, Amazon Echo, what works with that, what doesn't, and what you can expect to pay for it this season. Amazon has some serious competition with Google Home. We're going to check that out with Russell Holly. And also, if you're into the virtual reality issue, the trend of virtual reality, we'll be talking about a deal on the HTC Vive, I guess it's called. When it comes to laptops, Apple's going to have a deal on the new MacBook Air. We'll talk about that as well. Russell, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, so what's your top advice for shopping on the post, you know, in the post Thanksgiving blitz? What should people look for as far as red flags? How should people do it?
I think the most important thing is to know what it is. I have a rough idea of what it is that you're looking before you go in, and kind of get an idea for what those things already cost. So a lot of times you'll see prices, and it's really hard to distinguish whether or not something is actually a sale price or if it just seems like a really good deal because the numbers are very large and have colors on them. So it's often, you know, kind of not easy to tell unless you are familiar with the technology first. So if you have a rough idea of what it is that you're looking for, I would say that, you know, starting today, go and take a look and see what the actual prices of those products are and compare them to what the prices are going to be in these Black Friday ads and circulars.
So don't let yourself be inspired by the moment just because it's 5 o'clock in the morning and you've been waiting in line for 2 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't get desperate. All right. So let's take a look at some of the deals expected for this week. The Huawei Honor 8 smartphone. We've talked about this really pretty recently, but you can refresh our memories and tell us what the deal is.
Yeah, so this is a pretty great phone for someone who is on, you know, either T-Mobile or AT&T and is looking to do something that's not necessarily contract related. This is normally a $450 phone that'll be $300 on Black Friday.
And would you recommend it as a gift?
I think that if you have someone who likes taking pictures who isn't stuck to a particular brand, then this can be a really good phone for them.
Okay, and a good deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Another deal is for the Amazon Echo. Again, just a refresher on what the Echo is, what it does, and what the deal is.
Yeah, so Amazon's Echo is really kind of the first step at like a you know, kind of connected home. It's this pillar speaker that you can speak to that'll, you know, access your Amazon account and allow you to play music and will answer questions and you know, connect to a bunch of other apps and services should you decide to, you know, have things like smart lights or even if you want to just do something like order pizza.
Now you're talking. So what are some of the most useful things you found to do with Amazon Echo?
The biggest thing that I use just about every day, because for some reason I am just incapable of committing these things to memory, are measurement conversions in the kitchen. So if I want to know, you know, how many cups are in a gallon or something like that for whatever thing I'm working on in the kitchen, for some reason it is easier for me to ask this little pillar robot than it is to actually remember those things.
Could I use it for, like, recipes?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are recipe services where you can say, you know, give me a recipe for this, and it'll actually walk you through step by step.
Oh, man, that's what I could use, because I'm the one darting back and forth across the kitchen because I don't want to have the tablet or the phone sitting on my counter where it's going to get messed up.
And it's also good for simple alarms and timers. You know, you can have it, as an egg timer while it is doing other things.
So what's the deal with that?
Well, so they're normally $180, and they are going to be not necessarily on sale, but Amazon is making for the first time refurbished versions that have been certified by Amazon for $120.
What's your experience with refurbishing?
As long as they're actually certified by the manufacturer, every refurbished product that I've ever bought has worked really well. And
yep.
But that's the big thing there is it has to be certified by the manufacturer. If it's certified by a third party, it's not usually as successful.
Okay, so $120, that's a pretty good deal.
Absolutely.
Third off, yeah. what about someone who's thinking about Amazon Echo, but on the fence? It's got competition from Google Home. We're going to talk about that in a second. But what's this tipping point for you?
Well, so it really just depends what kind of user you are. You know, my house has got a ton of different kinds of technology from a bunch of different companies, so it's a little harder for me to kind of get stuck into one particular ecosystem. But if you're an Android user and you're used to Google services and you already have everything loaded into Google Calendar and stuff like that, then Google Home is an Echo competitor that works really, really well and will be available in Best Buy for $100 instead of the usual $130.
So that Google Home is cheaper to begin with. What's the big difference? What would you say?
Honestly, Google made it to be competitive. The speaker isn't you know, any really different than the Echo. It's a little smaller. The microphones are perhaps not as precise, but in most rooms, I don't notice a difference in performance between the two of them. It's really just whether you shop on Amazon more frequently than you check things on Google Calendar or listen to things on Google Play Music for YouTube.
Can you see people using both Google Home and Amazon?
Well, I don't know about people, but I have both in my house.
You're not normal, though.
Yeah, I know that that's something that would be common, but it's certainly possible.
Do you think that these things are going to get to be a thing, that it's going to be common?
I hope that, you know, whether by price or you know, kind of just software, you know, overflow, that this becomes the kind of thing where, you know, where it is something that, you know, people just kind of expect to be able to speak and have, you know, certain things happen in their home. Because it's absolutely kind of an extreme form of convenience right now. But to be able to lay in bed and say, you know, raise the temperature on my thermostat or turn the lights on in this room, it is really convenient in certain cases, especially if you're walking through a house with, you know, your arms full of groceries at 10 o'clock at night, as I occasionally find myself doing.
I also think that for people who are disabled and have mobility issues, gosh, that could be really helpful.
Absolutely. And in the case of Google Home, you know, they all network together. So if you end up purchasing multiples, you can actually have music play throughout your house on the speakers all synced together. So it can even be kind of a de facto studio or stereo system, depending on how your house is laid out.
Now, that's Google Home has that?
Yes. Amazon Echo doesn't network yet.
And so if Google Home does that, what's the price point on that? Do you get a break?
Yeah, so right now it's $100 in Best Buy where they're normally $130.
Mm-hmm. But you don't get a break if you buy more than one to network.
No, not right now. They're going to be $100 a piece if you were to get them on Black Friday. But gotcha. They do all network together. They also network together with Google's other connected stuff like the Chromecast systems. If you have Chromecast Audio. The little $35 accessory that'll connect to speakers that you already own.
Uh-huh.
Those will also connect with Google Home and allow you to kind of play music from all of them at the same time. And for people who have Chromecast on their television, I've only used this once or twice, and it's not as successful as it seems. But you can speak to it and have it play movies and things on the Chromecast without having to use your phone. You can say, you know, play this kind of video, and it'll go and it'll grab that video and play it on the Chromecast.
Wow. Okay. And have they been selling pretty well up to this point?
It's really early for Google Home to be certain, but Amazon has been selling the Echo very successfully over the last year.
Huh. All right. Great. Back to our virtual reality, our ongoing conversation about virtual reality. There is going to be a deal on the HTC. Is it Vive or Vive?
It's Vive.
Okay. Sorry. Of course, it's how it's spelled. What's the HTC Vive?
So this is, you know, kind of the most expensive, but at the same time, the most feature complete of the virtual reality systems. If you have a high performance gaming PC set up and you want, you know, kind of a full room virtual environment, you can set up something that fills a room that you can walk around in and kind of move with your arms and limbs and feel like you're part of this virtual experience, then the Vive is the system that you want. But like I said, it's also the most expensive of what's available now.
What's the deal on it later this week?
They're going to be $100 off for the system, which actually places it at the same price as its competitor, which is the Oculus Rift.
Which is how much?
It's going to be $6.99, whereas it's normally $7.99.
So this is for people with a little more cash on hand.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is very much, for someone who has been looking at it but not totally sold on the price.
And are you expecting VR systems to be a big gift this season, or do you think its time hasn't quite arrived?
No, I absolutely think that that's going to be a big part of gifting this year for a couple of reasons. There are going to be a couple of stores. We haven't been given actual prices yet, but there are going to be a couple of stores that are going to have Samsung's Galaxy S7 on sale, and with that will come the Samsung Gear VR cardboard setup, where you're getting virtual reality that way.
Mm-hmm.
And Sony hasn't had any bundles for PlayStation VR or the PlayStation 4, but like we said a couple weeks ago, because there are PlayStation VRs that are being sold as kind of refurbished bundles, the PlayStation 4 itself is going to be significantly cheaper in many places because you're buying them either used or you're buying an older model to go with a PlayStation VR to make the price of the whole kit significantly lower as well.
And all right, so there's going to be a lot of other options. You're just talking about top of the line when we're talking about HTC Vive.
Yeah, this is going to be the most significant bundle for someone who, like I said, already knows what it is that they want. If they're not really sure, or if you're in the process of looking for a gift for someone, then that decision is a little different.
How much can you test them out at Best Buy or wherever you get this stuff?
It depends on the headset, but in most places, Best Buy will give you demonstrations of PlayStation VR and Oculus Rift and the Samsung Gear VR headset. Those demonstrations are available. You usually can just walk in and ask, but they do have a website. Part of BestBuy.com is signing up for demonstration time slots where you can go in and there's someone there to walk you through all the features and show you how it all works.
Okay. All right. And if you're in the market for a laptop, Apple has a deal on the new MacBook Air. The MacBook Air, it's like what it sounds, very, very light.
Yes, very light, very thin, not the same as the MacBook Pro line that has been available. And this is actually something that Apple has not done before, to my recollection. This is making a brand new one of their laptops on a significant sale. These are usually $1,200 starting $1,200 laptops that are going to be available for $999 on Black Friday.
Okay, $200 off, not bad. And lastly, for the gamers out there, Xbox One Gears of War bundle will be on sale. I've definitely seen it advertised on television. For all the non-gamers, tell us briefly about Gears of War and what comes with this deal.
Gears of War is really kind of mindlessly violent with a story that has carried over for a couple of years now, for a couple of generations of games. And can be a lot of fun if you follow the story all the way through, but it is one of the most popular games for the Xbox One this year. And when paired with a new Xbox One, is usually closer to $350 to $400, depending on which Xbox you get. But there's going to be a bundle available in most stores on Black Friday that's going to have the Xbox One and a controller and Gears of War for $250.
Okay. All right. Anything else you could think of that people should be looking for? Anything you're kind of going to keep your eyes peeled for out there?
Well, I think the thing that we didn't get really a chance to talk about at all is kind of small stuff that I'm going to try and keep an eye out for. Things like, cases for phones or, battery packs to keep things charged when you're
stocking stuffers.
Those kind of things. Right. Those are the kind of things that we don't usually see. They don't usually announce ahead of time. We'll see them on Amazon for like one of the Cyber Monday flash sales or something like that. And that's going to be the kind of thing that I usually take a look at Monday morning and see what's available.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about it and see what you thought about it next Tuesday, okay?
All right.
All right. Russell Holley, contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com. I just want to take a minute to wish all of our listeners a very, very happy Thanksgiving. If you can avoid the crush, please do, and stay with family and friends. And that's the reason for the season, I guess, is one way you could put it. Thanks to the AllSides staff, and wish them a very happy Thanksgiving. Producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, the AllSides interns, Walter Hopp,
Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Don't forget to like All Sides on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides, and follow me too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening, and have a very happy holiday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Join us.